was going to be sort of giving lectures or classes or other than writing workshops. So I had prepared a rather thick wadge of material on basically hermetic linguistics. And if there's no objection, I would like to devote the majority of our time together to presenting this material, which is rather complex. And if we're going to do any writing as a group, I would sort of prefer it to be done outside of our class hours so we don't spend any time with that. However, I mean, that we don't waste any time together and just sitting quietly writing, which is something that I don't think we enjoy. I don't think we enjoy just sitting around and doing nothing while you all write. Are there any objections to, I mean, did you all expect to write in this class, or do you have any expectations which, were you going to promise something? Well, if there's no objection, then let me do what I intended to do today. In the last minutes of the session, we'll talk about the question of writing something. when I heard I was going to be talking in Hermetic Week, I thought I'd better say something about Hermetics. And the word floated into my mind, hermetalinguistics. From Hermes and from meta linguistics. And I realized that it sounded like it ought to be something that really exists, but as far as I knew, it didn't. So basically, over the past few months, I have been inventing a new school of linguistics. Major topic that I want to deal with. But before I even get to that, Hermetic linguistics proper, as it were, I want to talk about what I call anti-linguistics. And I'll start with a story about the god Hermes, which is relevant and which you may have heard because it's very famous. And that is that Hermes, of course, invented writing. And when he went to Zeus, the father of the gods, to boast about his new invention and what a great thing it was, what a great boon it would be for humanity, that they would now have records of everything, would never have to forget anything. Zeus said, on the contrary, now they would forget everything because they'll depend on writing and they'll lose their memory. And indeed, so it happened. Writing proved to be the end of oral literature for many cultures. And it's still only in illiterate cultures, non-literate cultures, that you still find anything approaching an oral tradition. So right away, from the very beginning of writing, we find a distrust of writing. I mean, the very invention of writing is bound up with a distrust of writing. But it goes deeper than this. It goes all the way to a distrust of words themselves. Now, this distrust has always been with humanity, I think, probably from the very beginning. Again, as we see in the very origin legend of writing, contains embedded within it a condemnation of writing. Probably the very origin of language contained within it, embedded within it, some kind of critique of language itself. But it's really only since the 18th, 19th century, and what we call modernism, even if you like, that this distrust of words has reached what I would consider to be crisis. And what I want to deal with in the haven't noticed that there's a crisis in poetry, then I don't think you've really paid much attention to what's going on. I think that poetry has become hermetic in a bad sense of the word, if you like, in that it's a closed operation without an audience, except the poet, by and large. And the official world of poetry has a certain deadly boredom inherent in it since the modern period. And modernism, in a sense, in one very real sense, has been an attempt to deal with this boredom and this very distrust of the word. for me, the distrust really, in the modern period, really gets underway with Nietzsche, with Nietzsche. And I have a few quotations from him that I think will illuminate what I'm talking about. Now, these quotations are all from The Will to Power, which is the book that Nietzsche did not publish during his lifetime. It consists of notes that he was keeping, some of which he worked into his published works, and other aspects of The Will to Power were not worked into his published works. And among those aspects were his writings on language. Nietzsche himself was a great philologist, which is to say, a typical linguist of the 19th century, in that he was not trained in structural linguistics. He was not interested in the structure of language, because this is something that only happened later in early 20th century, with Ferdinand de Saussure, S-A-U-S-S-U-R-E, who, by the way, was influenced by Nietzsche, which I can prove, but it doesn't seem worthwhile, really. So what Nietzsche has to say about language, I think, is of extraordinary interest, because he gave up philology. He did something very much like what Rambeau did with poetry, except that he kept on writing. But instead of working in philology, he worked in theory, philosophy, if you like. I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I think Nietzsche was probably the first theorist in the modern sense of the word. But behind his whole project was a revulsion against the word, and a revulsion against the very academic background that he came out of, which was philology. So whenever he has something to say about language itself, it's a good idea, I think, to pay very close attention, because Nietzsche is a kind of hidden influence in all of modern thought. And The Will to Power is a gold mine of ideas which are later brought out by other European, mostly European thinkers. I could give plenty of examples, but this linguistic one is just one of many. Now, in The Will to Power, I'll just read you a few quotes. He says, "We set up a word at the point at which our ignorance begins, at which we can see no further. For example, the word I, the word do, the word suffer. These are perhaps the horizon of our knowledge, but they're not truths." In other words, they have no, here's the very beginning of the idea that the word is arbitrary, the sign is arbitrary, that it is not tied down to any archetype, to any pre-existent reality, to any substantial reality. Elsewhere, by the way, I couldn't track down this exact quote, but somewhere in The Will to Power, Nietzsche says, "I fear we have not gotten rid of God because we have not gotten rid of grammar." Now, this in a sense is, you know, in a nutshell, the entire linguistic position. And what he means by this, well, first of all, he means it quite literally. But he also means that we have not gotten rid of the kind of spook in our brain, because that spook is created by words. The whole idea of transcendence and of what Kant called the categorical imperative, the thing which has existence in itself, Nietzsche rejects. And he rejects it all the way down to the level of language. And he goes even farther than that. He rejects it at the level of cause and effect. He says, "We have absolutely no experience of cause. Psychologically considered, we derive the entire concept from the subject conviction that we are causes, namely that the arm moves, but that is an error. We separate ourselves, the doers, from the deed, and we make use of this pattern everywhere. We seek a doer for every event. What is it we have done. We have misunderstood the feeling of strength, tension, resistance, a muscular feeling, body feeling. It is already the beginning of the act as the cause. We have mistaken this muscular tension for a cause in our brain. Or that it was mistaken for a cause because the action seems to follow upon it. But there is no such thing as cause. At length we grasp that things, consequently atoms too, affect nothing because they do not exist at all. That the concept of causality is completely useless. A necessary sequence of states does not imply a causal relationship between them. There are neither causes nor effects. Linguistically, we do not know how to rid ourselves of them, but that does not matter. If I think of the muscle apart from its effects, I'm jaded. I don't know what that means. There's a lot of very difficult stuff in the world of power, but this is the sentence I want to focus in on. Linguistically, we don't know how to rid ourselves of these dualities of cause and effect, or indeed of any duality, because the very structure of the language, what Nietzsche is saying, creates in our mind a false perception of duality. This already, to me, is a very mystical statement, which is very much in tune with mysticism. And I think Nietzsche might owe a little bit here to the German Protestant mystics, the Catholic mystics of the Middle Ages, which he read, I know, with great interest. Despite the fact that Nietzsche is an atheist and declares that his principle is to get rid of God by getting rid of grammar, in effect, what he's talking about is something very mystical, because if you could go beyond language in a sense, beyond duality in a sense, you would have presumably the kind of unified consciousness that the mystics talk about. And here in a Buddhist institute as we are, it's very easy to talk about getting rid of God without necessarily getting rid of spirituality, and that's a very important point that's going to recur all through what I'm talking about. We can get rid of God in the sense of a monotheistic no-go-daddy, as Blake called it. We can get rid of God in the sense of a constrictive grammar that exists inside our brains without getting rid of the impulse towards spirituality, as we see, for example, in Buddhism has even been called an atheistic religion. I think that's a bit of a misnomer. But it's certainly true when you compare it with Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And especially when you get into the extremer forms of radical Buddhism, such as Zen, or the brand of Buddhism they teach around here. So I think we can take Nietzsche's statement without getting all upset about atheism and modernism, and express it as a Sufi would say, we have not gotten rid of the false god of our limited consciousness, because we have not gotten rid of it. And in other words, we can sort of do a Buddhist reinterpretation of what Nietzsche is saying here, which is weird, and he would have hated it, but nevertheless, it's something that I want to propose to you. That right away, even in this, what looks like the ultimate onslaught of the word, already the seeds of some kind of saving the phenomena are here, and we'll get back to that. Compared with music, all communication by words is shameless. Words dilute and brutalize. Words depersonalize. Words make the uncommon common. This, I think, in 2.5 lines here is the entire anti-linguistic position. All laid out for us. And we'll be getting back to Nietzsche again and again, because there are many more fascinating things that he has to say about language. But basically, I feel that it was through Nietzsche that this whole idea of the arbitrary nature of the word was finally crystallized for our civilization. And flowing out from Nietzsche, we have people like Saussure, and the general semantics of Brzezinski, and this relative relativistic linguistics of Sapir, don't worry about the names, I'm just tossing them off here to get around to some of them and some of them you won't. Of course, none of them ever make any reference to Nietzsche because he's a very embarrassing figure for many people, especially because of the misuse the Nazis made of him. And this may be the only context in which you all have heard of Nietzsche, and I just want you to realize that was a scandalous misuse of Nietzsche. And there's many, many more aspects to his thinking than his so-called proto-fascism. In fact, anarchists have always dipped into Nietzsche for inspiration. So he's one of those oceans of thought that many people can dig a pearl from. But let me just, as an example, give you what I would consider to be almost an unconscious repetition of Nietzsche's thought. And this is from the linguist Edward Sapir, S-A-P-I-R. Human beings do not live in the objective world alone, nor alone in the world of social activity, as ordinarily understood, but are very much at the mercy of the particular language which has become a medium of expression for their society. It is quite an illusion to imagine that one adjusts to reality essentially without the use of language, and that language is merely an incidental means of solving specific problems of communication and reflection. The fact of the matter is that the, quote, real world, unquote, is to a large extent unconsciously built up on the language habits of the group. No two languages are ever sufficiently similar to be considered as representing the same social reality. The worlds in which different societies live are distinct worlds, not merely the same world with different labels attached. That's terrifying. Language not only refers to experience largely acquired without its help, but actually defines experience for us by reason of its formal completeness. And because of our unconscious projection of its implicit expectations and concealed experience, such categories as number, gender, case, tense are not so much discovered in experience as imposed upon it because of the tyrannical hold that linguistic form has upon our orientation in the world. All these words, terror, tyranny. I mean, we're clearly dealing with emotionally laden language here. It's not merely a scientist talking, this is someone who's in a state of panic. Yes. All right, recently a book that came out by an anarchist thinker whose work I enjoy very much, named John Zerzan, Z-E-R-Z-A-F, and his book is called Elements of Refusal. It's published by Left Bank Books in Seattle in 1988. And one of the chapters in this book, his thesis is that there are many gestures of refusal, almost unconscious, going on in a broad scale in the world of the capital and in the world of the social as well, the other world. In other words, in the capitalist world and in the Marxist world, such as not voting, such as not learning to read, such as cheating on the job, changing jobs frequently, not caring about the work situation, the loss of the Protestant ethic, and so forth and so on. And all of these unconscious gestures of refusal he sees as somehow positive, in the sense that they're a healthy reaction on the part of many, many people at once to a false consciousness which has been perpetrated largely by the state and by economic interests, but really by society in its deepest form. So one of the chapters in his book is an attack on language, which is the most thoroughgoing attack on language that I could come up with. And so I'm presenting it to you as the quintessence of the anti-linguistic position. And that will involve me reading a few quotations for a while. I have an entire copy of the chapter in question, and if anybody finds this interesting, I'd be glad for you to have it Xerox for you, but I do recommend the book very strongly. It's very thought-provoking. I don't by any means agree with everything that Zerzan says, but it's very stimulating. Anyway, in much the same sense as objectified time has been held to be essential to consciousness, Hegel called it the necessary alienation, so has language, and equally falsely. Language may be properly considered the fundamental ideology, perhaps as deep a separation from the natural world as self-existent time. time, which he also considers an illusion. And if timelessness resolves the split between spontaneity and consciousness, timelessness resolves the split between spontaneity and consciousness, languagelessness may be equally necessary. Language is the subject of this exploration, understood in its virulent sense. And he introduces the quote from Nietzsche about music, which I just read, so he leaves out the comparison to music. Words dilute and brutalize, words depersonalize, words make the uncommon common. Ideology, alienation's armored way of seeing, is the domination embedded in systematic false consciousness. It is easier still to begin to locate language in these terms if one takes up another definition common to both ideology and language, namely that each is a system of distorted communication between two poles and predicated upon symbolization. Like ideology, language creates false separations and objectifications through its symbolizing power. This falsification is made possible by concealing and ultimately vitiating, taking the energy out of, the participation of the subject in the physical world. It is reality revealed only ideologically as a stratum separate from us, language is. In this way, language creates and debases the world. As George Steiner says, human speech conceals far more than it confides. It blurs much more than it defines. It distances more than it connects. Of course, this is part of the tendency to see reality symbolically, of which Chiorin, the French thinker, referred to as the sticky symbolic net of language, an infinite regression which cuts us off from the world. The arbitrary self-contained nature of language's symbolic organization creates growing areas of false certainty where wonder, multiplicity, and non-equivalence should prevail. Roland Barthes' description of language as absolutely terrorist is much to the point here. He saw that its systematic nature, quote, in order to be complete, needs only to be valid and not to be true. Later on, we'll find that one linguist came up with the theory that language was invented in order that human beings could lie. Along these lines, in terms of structure, which is true, poetry after all, along these lines, in terms of structure, it is evident that freedom of speech does not exist. Grammar is the invisible thought control of our invisible prison. With language, we have already accommodated ourselves to a world of unfreedom. Since all intentions and emotions are involuntarily expressed by gesture, look, or sound, oh yeah, here it is, voluntary communication such as language, says E.H. Sturtevant, must have been invented for the purpose of lying or deceiving. It may be that while language and technology are indeed linked, they were both successfully resisted for thousands of generations. This is his critique of the idea that technology and language develop in tandem. But the question is, why did technology not develop for millions of years of human history? Because it was resisted, not just because people were too primitive to think of it. It's implicit in his hypothesis, and I find it fascinating. Engels, who valorized labor even more explicitly than Marx, explained the origin of language from and with labor, the mastery of nature. He expressed the essential connection by the phrase, first labor, after it, and then with it, speech. To put it more critically, the artificial communication which is language was and is the voice of the artificial separation which is division of labor. In the usual repressive parlance, this is phrased positively, of course, in terms of the invaluable nature of language in organizing individual responsibilities. And of course, the Marxists are very much pro-work. So that means that they're all in favor of this idea. Language was elaborated for the suppression of feelings as the code of civilization that expresses the sublimation of eros, the repression of instinct, which is the core of civilization. Freud, in the one paragraph he devoted to the origin of language, connected original speech to sexual bonding as the instrumentality by which work was made acceptable as an equivalence and substitute for sexual activity. This transference from a free sexuality to work is the original sublimation, and Freud
catch-all language constituted in the establishment of the link between making calls and work processes. The neo-Freudian Lacan carries this analysis further, asserting that the unconscious is formed by the primary repression of the acquisition of language. For Lacan, the unconscious is thus structured like a language and functions linguistically, not instinctively or symbolically in the traditional Freudian sense. At the close of the Paleolithic Age, as a decreased proportion of verbs in the language reflected the decline of unique and freely chosen acts and consequently division of labor, language still possessed no tenses. Although the creation of a symbolic world was the condition for the existence of time, no fixed differentiations had developed before hunter-gatherer life was displaced by Neolithic farming. But when every verb form shows a tense, language is demanding lip service to time, even when time is furthest from our thought. From this point on, one can ask whether time exists apart from grammar. Once the structure of speech incorporates time and is thereby animated by it at every expression, division of labor has conclusively destroyed an earlier reality, which, as you can see, Zerzan hypothesizes that the earlier reality, the Stone Age reality, was a much more unified reality. With Derrida, Jacques Derrida, one can accurately refer to language as the origin of history. Language itself is a repression, and along its progress, repression gathers as ideology, as work, so as to generate historical time. Without language, all of history would disappear. As Levi Strauss put it, writing seems to favor rather the exploitation than the enlightenment of mankind. Writing, on this its first appearance in our midst, has allied itself with falsehood. The gestures of refusal of the prison of language, another terrorist phrase here. Since Mallarmé, a good deal of modernist poetry and prose has moved against the taking for grantedness of normal speech. The question, who is speaking, Mallarmé answers, language is speaking, in very much the same sense that Nietzsche and Safir answered, I believe. After this reply, and especially since the explosive period around World War I, when Joyce and Wittgenstein and others attempted a new syntax as well as a new vocabulary, the restraints and distortions of language have been assaulted wholesale in literature. Russian futurists, Dada, Artaud, the surrealists, and Letlists were among the more exotic elements of a general resistance to language. The symbolist poets, and many who could be called their descendants, held that defiance of society also includes defiance of its language. But inadequacy in the former area precluded success in the latter, bringing one to ask whether avant-garde strivings can be anything more than abstract hermetic gestures, hermetic in the negative sense. The defiance of society includes defiance of its language, but inadequacy in the former arena, the failure of revolution, precluded success in the latter, for example. Bringing one to ask whether avant-garde strivings can be anything more than abstract phonetic gestures. Language, which at any given moment embodies the ideology of a particular culture, must be ended in order to abolish both categories of estrangement, a project of some considerable social dimensions. The literary texts, for example, Finnegan's Wake, the poetry of T.G. Cummings, break the rules of language, seems mainly to have the paradoxical effect of invoking the rules themselves. By permitting the free play of ideas about language, society treats these ideas as mere play. So much for the avant-garde. The deterioration of language mirrors a more general estrangement. It has become almost totally external to us. From Kafka to Pinter, silence itself is a fitting voice of our times. As R.D. Lang put it so well, few books are forgivable. I love that quote. Black on the canvas, silence on the screen, an empty white sheet of paper are perhaps beautiful. Meanwhile, the structuralists, Levi Strauss, Bach, Foucault, Lacan, Derrida, have been almost entirely occupied with the duplicity of language, we'll get to that school of thought later, and their endless exegetical burrowings into it. They have virtually renounced the project of extracting meaning from language. We couldn't live in this world without language, and that is just how profoundly we must transform this world. Words bespeak a sadness. They are used to soak up the emptiness of unbridled time. We have all had the desire to go further, deeper than words, the feeling of wanting only to be done with all the talk, knowing that being allowed to live coherently erases the need to formulate coherently. There is a profound truth in the notion that lovers need no words. The point is that we must have a world of lovers, a world of face-to-face, in which even names can be forgotten, a world which knows that enchantment is the opposite of ignorance. Only a politics that undoes language and time, and is thus visionary to the point of voluptuousness, has any meaning.
So this, as I say, is this problem. I'll run off some copies of this. This, as I say, is the most terrifying attack on language, sort of synthesized to all the negative strains that have gone into thinking about language in the modern period. And this is what I call the crisis of poetry. I think this is why poetry seems boring to so many people. In other words, poetry is treated to a gesture of refusal, just as if it were on the same level as the horse shit that the government puts out, defined so well, newspeak. It doesn't matter to a high school kid now whether he's being forced to read the newspeak or his social hygiene text or a Shakespearean sonnet. It's all smeared out to the same level of meaninglessness. And this is why we find what all the liberal commentators spend all their time kissing about, the so-called new illiteracy, is actually one of these gestures of refusal. And I think as poets, this should be particularly horrifying to us. We're failing to do what I think Zerzan's critique is. I will eventually answer this critique, I hope, with some degree of believability. But I think the critique is incredibly strong. And if we don't face up to this critique, we're going to be in the deep shit as poets. Because if we just pretend that the 19th and 20th centuries never happened. And I went to a conference recently where guys stood up and said, I write 17th century poetry, and nobody will publish it. And where can I get it published? Well, that was what he was interested in. And in other words, he had burrowed himself, I presume, into some very comfortable little hole where Nietzsche never happened, where the French theorist never happened, where this whole distrust of language had never emerged, and who was just happily writing 17th century poetry. But I don't think that's an option for most of us. I mean, clearly the guy wasn't happy because he wasn't being published, but presumably could be happy doing that. But I really don't think that would be, and I'll accept that if you want to, that you want to just write medieval blues poetry, fine, go off and enjoy it, do it. But if we've had any contact with the modernist position at all, I'm going to have to take into consideration this, in a sense, reductio ad absurdum of Zerzan, because it's very convincing. It strikes deep into something which I think we've probably all felt, this distrust of words, this desire to go beyond words. Okay, that's the sort of, very briefly, the anti-linguistic position, as I call it. And basically what I want to do over our time together is somehow try to answer this critique of the anti-linguist. And in order to do so, I think it's going to be necessary for us to penetrate all the way back to the original theory of language and then trace that through the 18th century with the beginning of the age of so-called reason, and carry that into the 19th century, into the creation of biology and linguistics, as we know today, and then finally into the 20th century, especially some of these French thinkers who are dealing with language. And then, as I say, finally, my project will be to bring in a new scientific theory about chaos and see if, by using that as a tool, you can't arrive at a synthesis, a new linguistic synthesis that might offer at least a finger pointing to an exit sign
crisis of poetry and distrust of language. So that's my project. I want to answer these charges of hatred and sort of vice versa. Oh, I might add, before we leave anti-linguistics, I wanted to offer tribute to William Burroughs, who I think is, has expressed this entire position also very, very well in some of his writing. He was, of course, very much influenced by Krasinski's Final Semantics. Now, I haven't had a chance to really delve too deep into that, but as I understand it, Final Semantics is another one of these ways of looking at language as an arbitrary construct. And the slogan, the famous slogan from Krasinski, the map is not the territory, is something that Burroughs has repeated. By which he means, very simply, really almost stupidly simply, the word is not the thing, the sign is not the signifier, the signifier is not the signifier, the map is not the territory. Burroughs is very much in the whole, he's centrally located in the distrust of language tendency. And in fact, the cut-up technique, which in a sense he and Geisen borrowed from Dada and gave him a new lease on life, is one of the most straightforward attacks on language, per se, that's been carried out in the modernist project. The idea that you could totally arbitrate, you could take this structure, which in itself is already arbitrary, and make it more arbitrary, like, you know, this sort of samurai gesture of just splitting into it. And I think especially in The Exterminator, which is one of his earlier works, collaborated with Geisen, a lot of this thinking is at its clearest, and I think that's where he repeats his slogan about cut out the word. There's a whole rub out the word, which again is a neat little sloganization of this entire anti-linguistic position that we talked about. So, actually, I was thinking, instead of anti-linguistics, we call this whole school of thought heavy metal linguistics, because Burroughs, as well, coined the term heavy metal, and this idea of words as somehow compacting in on themselves, like a black hole sucking all gravity and light into all meaning, as it were, makes both the language kind of heavy metal, and yet, at the same time, it goes beyond language, meta beyond it. And so perhaps heavy metal linguistics would be a nice portmanteau of words to describe what I'm calling the anti-linguistic tradition. And so we'll use that term from the bill refer to the whole idea of short code. And I think also, I haven't had a chance to, have anybody read The Job, the book of the first interview that just came out? Have you? Does it talk about this in there? I don't know, actually, if someone could advise me on where in Burroughs you would find the most complete exposition of these ideas, I think it's an Exterminator.
Is the book of breathing?
Uh-huh, I have read that. But wait, is that the one with the Mayan stuff in it? No, I haven't read it.
It's also about Burroughs.
It is, uh-huh. Yeah, I think he got into Krasinski through Scientology, obviously, because Krasinski was also an influence on Ron Hubbard about the Dianetics. And Burroughs was interested in that for a while, and then he found out that basically, I think what he found out was that Hubbard was just ripping off people who were a lot smarter than him. And he lost interest in Scientology and went to Hubbard's own sources, which included Krasinski.
Another fact is that he was
not. Yeah. If I ever do work all this material in an article, I'm going to have to actually go to the university to find out exactly what the name of the book is. All right, I think that takes us to an answer to this. Oh, wait a minute. No, one more point I want to make. To me, the crisis moment in its whole story occurs with Rimbaud, especially his sonnet, The Vowels, which I suggest you go and look up and reread if you haven't read it for a while. I did not bring that with me. Maybe I'll get that. I want to be in the library. I'll get that passed around. In this
sonnet, this leads us right into our next chapter, so to speak. In this sonnet, what Rimbaud was trying to do was to save the phenomena of the entire occult tradition, but the Western occult tradition, but by extension, the entire occult tradition, by saying that there is something absolutely good. Where he tried to assign the vowel color to the role of the poem, as if this was a scientific statement. And later on, in his last letters, that he attacks himself and his foolish ideas before giving up writing forever, he specifically discusses the song says that he literally believed he was going to create an language and that he literally meant quite literally that vowels have colors. It seemed to be an incontrovertible scientific fact of the word, in the old sense of the word, scientia, perhaps rather than the new sense of the word, wisdom, knowing, knowledge. And then when he came to see that he had been deluded in this, that it was some sort of a hallucinatory trip of his systematic arrangement of the senses, and he turned his back on the entire idea that there could be anything absolute in language. And so when Rimbaud gave up writing, this was one of these silences observed on Tolkien, one of these terribly present absences in modern literature, a resounding nothingness which has stayed with us ever since. And I love the fact that Rimbaud went off to Abyssinia, the abyss, because it couldn't have been more appropriate. He might have even chosen that as his last poem to make that pun out of his entire life, to go to the abyss of Abyssinia and deal guns with natives instead of writing poetry anymore. So I see that as a prescient moment for seeing the entire 20th century on the part of Rimbaud, which really went unnoticed. Sense that, first of all, Rimbaud, although in our view you would think of him as a native poet, in France was really not considered for a long time, and maybe even still, people would say that he's not treated with the same degree of seriousness as many other poets, and he certainly has rarely been treated with the seriousness that they think. But I believe that this was a profound moment of thought in the history of our literature, and the result of it was silence. And it's for us, if we wish to carry on as poets and not follow Rimbaud into the Abyssinia, it's for us to answer the silence, confront the silence once again with words. And that's what I want to see if we can do it. Again, as I say, the project of these lectures is to deal with a crisis, catastrophic. And I'll come back to that word catastrophe again and again in many different meanings. And we begin with the negative. We are in a state of collapse, of course. And we're all headed for that abyss, we're all headed for that black hole, if we can't think of a way out of these arguments that they've presented, which I think you'll all agree are incredibly powerful and convincing. So, in order to do that, what I want to spend the rest of today talking to you about, basically, is traditional linguistics. Now, the oldest idea of language is the one that held sway from the first moment that we have any knowledge of theory of language until the 18th century, unchallenged even through the Copernican Revolution. Language was not one of the things that was overturned by Galileo. Has all fallen under the heading of, well, it's interesting to approach it in the question of the origin of language, to look to see what each of these schools of thought thinks about the origin of language, because if you know the origin, you know the whole thing, in a sense. You know the seed, you know the tree. So the original theory of the origin of language is that it's revealed. What does that mean? In
Genesis, interestingly enough, Adam already somehow knows the names. So right from the very beginning of the traditional revealed theory of the origin of language, we have a peculiar embedding, and the embedding is that somehow the names are innate in Adam as his they're part of his created being. So God doesn't have to coach him specifically on the naming of the things in the garden. It is he himself, man as microcosm, man as direct reflection of the divine, Adam as the first prophet, which is the Islamic way of looking at him, the Sufi way of looking at him. We have already another theory embedded within the revelation theory, and that is the language is innate. The third theory, which we get to in the 18th century, is that language is invented. And then you might say that the fourth theory, this is problematic. There could be said to be a fourth way of looking at things that refuses to deal with the problem of origins, thinking of it as a false question. So that could be perhaps a diagram of the cosmos, which is completely and purely traditional, belongs to all the Western traditions, this concept of the cosmos that we're going to look at. But I chose it out of all the mandalas that I could have presented you with because it has letters in it. It shows that it shows letters coming from the above, which is also, in a sense, the center. They're Hebrew letters because in the Judeo-Christian tradition, Hebrew was long thought to be the language of God. It was thought that God actually spoke Hebrew. And many of the early theorists of language thought that if language could be traced to its origins, it would be found that everyone originally spoke Hebrew. So, for example, when the first wolf children were discovered, the wild children, also Raj, there was a hypothesis that they would be speaking Hebrew words. And this happened in the 17th century. I forget who was responsible for this, some English people, I think. And they found, to their dismay, that the children seemed to be speaking Phrygian. How the hell they knew it was Phrygian, I don't know. It clearly was not either Hebrew or Phrygian. It was nothing. Because, of course, later on, in the 19th century, there was some wonderful film by Truffaut, The Wildfire, very accurate. Fascinating study of the best documented and earliest wildfire cases. The boy in question never acquired language, and none of the wild children who were subsequently studied who were brought in at any age older than, say, 8 or 9 have ever been able to acquire language. And this is remarkable because clearly they're human beings, and clearly thought was going on in their brains, and clearly they must have thought because they survived. So this is a fascinating movie. The wild children brought a fascinating problem to language right from the beginning. I would say in recent years there's been a tendency to ignore the phenomenon because it's so embarrassing in such so many theories, except possibly sociolinguistics, which is a subset of the rational approach, which says that language is entirely social. Phenomenon. And we could mix that in also with Piaget, with the French psychologist, findings about stages of development, so that you get past a certain stage of development without acquiring the skills that belong socially to that stage of development, and never acquire the skills. If the genes, presumably, we hypothesize, the genetic structure is activated at a certain point to deal with language. There is nobody around speaking the language, then you never acquire language. So this is an interesting little sideway. We probably have an occasion to discuss again. But I want to talk about the idea of language as revealed, and a few relevant, I hope, quotations, starting out with the Jewish, later Jewish tradition, Proto-Babylonian Jewish tradition, of the wonderful book, the third book of Enoch, the Hebrew book of Enoch, which is a pseudo-biblical book. It was never accepted in anybody's Bible, but it still survives, and it's a fascinating book.
Citron, Princess of Divine Presence, of glory of highest heaven, said to me, out of the abundant love and great compassion wherewith the Holy One, blessed be He, loved and cherished me more than all the denizens of the heights, He wrote with His finger as with a pen of flame upon the crown which was on my head the letters by which heaven and earth were created, the letters by which seas and rivers were created, the letters by which mountains and hills were created, the letters by which stars and constellations, lightning, the wind, the thunder and thunderclaps, snow and hail, hurricane and tempest were created, the letters by which all the necessities of the world and all the orders of creation were created. Each letter flashed time after time like lightning, time after time like torches, time after time like flames, time after time like the rising of the sun, moon, and stars. So here is very clearly stated the idea that the creation itself takes place by the form of letters. And there was no separation in the mind of the traditional writers here between language and writing. The language and writing were for them virtually identical at this point. So that, for example, in Islamic or Sufi cosmology, it's often expressed in terms of the whole of creation, the whole of man's being, of human being, the being of humanness, is expressed in the metaphors of writing. So the divine pen, the divine tablet, the divine pen writes upon the divine tablet, and the things come into being. Looking at this, this is now we're in the diagram that I'm passing around, we're looking at things from God's point of view, so to speak. Looking at it from man's point of view, we have the whole range of thinking of systems such as Kabbalah, gematria, numerology, letter of numerology, or various ways of deconstructing, if I really believe that's the right word, language itself, in order to get back to that divine language, get it, break it down into the letters, the creative letters, thus approach God by climbing that ladder of letters that we see in the diagram. Let's see, it also says, all the sacred, when the ministering angels recite the Sanctus, the Holy, the Kadosh, all the sacred names, the grave, the pen of flame, and the throne of glory, fly off like eagles with 16 wings, and encompass and surround the Holy One, blessed be He, on the four sides of the abode of His glorious Shekinah. It's the space, the divine space, the Shekinah. The angels of the host, the fiery ministers, the Ophanim of power, the Kerubim of the Shekinah, the holy creatures, the Seraphim, the Erelim and Tapsarim, these are the ranks of angels, the cohorts of flame, the cohorts of devouring fire, the ranks of firebrands, the hosts of flame, the holy princes crowned with crowns, robed with royalty, covered with glory, girded with beauty, girt with magnificence, girdled with majesty, fall prostrate three times and say, blessed be the name of the glorious King of earth. That's all by the virtue of the letters. And it's not any accident, by the way, that all of this talking about letters and language combines with the discussion of the angels and of angelology. And this, in order to explain the traditional theory of linguistics, it would be necessary to say a little something about angelology. You'll notice another reason why I chose this mandala is because there are little angels spiraling down, not along the straight lines of the letters, but along a spiral line, spiraling down from on high into the center, which is the world, consciousness. Now, in Greek, angelos means messenger. And the picture of the angel comes from the picture, the traditional picture of Hermes, who is the messenger of gods, the winged messenger. Christian iconography, and I, by the way, dealt with that in one of my books, Angels. The angels are the means by which they are the actual active means, the efficient cause of how language gets revealed, how it comes down from God or from our life into the consciousness. This happens to angels. And the whole of angelology is full of metaphors of words. In fact, ultimately, probably the most extreme example of this would be in Manichaean thinking, where the messenger and the same thing. So you have, for example, in, I believe, the Book of the Pearl or the Book of Thomas, somewhere, some Gnostic text, pre-Manichaean text, you have a book, which is also a bird, which flies down from the Father in heaven, from the Holy Family in heaven, so to speak, to the exiled soul in the world of matter, and it calls. It's the Manichaean angelic call, the call of the soul back from its dispersal in the world of matter into the pure aroma of pure being. But all in all, the, even in the Orthodox traditions, and in all the mystical traditions, at least of monotheism and really of every tradition must have this mediating factor, because when you talk about a transcendent and an immanent, if there are two poles of reality, there must always be a connecting link. And metaphysically, there must always be some way of connecting these two things. Symbolically, that way of connecting those two things are the angels. So the angels, they're not the angels of the rain and the frost and the storehouse of the winds and other poetic phrases from scripture and pseudo-scripture, but they're even more importantly, the angels are words. And traditional grammatology is an angelology, if it could be said with complete accuracy, I think. So language itself is personified as a winged figure, carrying words back and forth, to and from human consciousness, from and to the logos itself. Now, in theological terms, they often talk about how the angels come down to hear our prayers and then carry them on their wings back to the Almighty. This is kind of sort of sentimental monotheism. Monotheism is the burial of the scheme in the angel's language. Let's see. So, what I want to do with this diagram now is reduce it even further into three levels, because we have the transcendent and the immanent, we have God in the world, so to speak, and then we have this realm in between. And in order to understand the traditional theory of language, it will be necessary, most of all, to understand that in-between world. That isthmus, as the Sufis call it, the barzakh, the world of the isthmus that connects the two seas, you know? The sea of the transcendent and of the immanent. The nature of that in-between world, according to Sufism, and I'm getting specifically into Islamic doctrine, but this is something that can't be found anywhere, it just happens to be expressed very neatly in Sufism, and I just happen to know more about that. The content or the nature of that in-between world is the imagination. Not the imagination in the sense of what a spiritual teacher would call vain fantasy, but the imagination in the sense of that faculty by which we image things, by which we have in ourselves images of things which are in fact outside ourselves. That closing up of the inside-outside dichotomy, that's what the imagination is. And therefore, it's uniquely the faculty which can connect, according to traditional theory, this solid material world with the purely, in a sense, purely spiritual world, or the world of pure potentiality, which is the divine. In order to get those words down, what is the ladder by which, what is the Jacob ladder by which the angels descend and ascend as words? It is the world of the imagination. Or as Henry Corbin called it in Latin to make it sound a little different and more impressive, the mundus imaginalis. And that escapes our corrupted meaning of the word imagination and gives you the idea of the images and the imaginal function in human consciousness. There are many ways of describing the imaginal world, all the way from very fanciful mythological ways, which see them as spiritual cities where the demons and angels reside. And there's even talk of emerald cities, usually enough, kind of Oz imagery, if you like. But I'm more interested in the function than in the mythology now of the imaginal world.
And the function could be summed up in the word archetypes. Probably most of you are familiar with the concept of archetypes from Jung, and it's a good starting point, but it has to be emphasized that the traditions don't use the word archetypes in the same way that Jung did. He borrowed the term from the tradition and changed it slightly to refer to the collective unconscious. Now, this is a hypothesis that was not made in the traditional world. The archetypes are not in a collective unconscious, they are, in a sense, in a collective supra-consciousness. They partake to a certain degree of some kind of reality. They're not dreams. They have some kind of substance, and it behooves us to figure out exactly what kind of substance that is, because don't forget, we're dealing with the genesis of language itself here. And the Sufis say that there are, now I have to understand the Arabic language is made up of triliteral roots. Every word in Arabic is based on a three-letter root which can be rearranged in any way. It's a very strange system. Many linguists have gone so far as to think that it was artificial, and therefore it fits in with the idea of language is invented, because it's so systematic that the idea of a triliteral rather than a two-letter root or a four-letter root is so arbitrary and yet so universal in Arabic that it's a puzzle to historical linguists to figure out where this idea came from. So Arabic, in a way, was constituted by its very nature to understand the idea of roots, which didn't come into Western consciousness until Sanskrit was discovered in the 19th century. And people realized that Sanskrit was full of roots of Latin and Greek and Gothic and High German and all this. And suddenly the idea of roots as the way tracing language became popular in the West. This idea was always there in Arabic because it's so obvious in Arabic that all words are accompanied by little roots. And there's a saying which I haven't been able to track down to an exact source, it's probably just a tradition, that the number of triliteral roots is the same as the number of fixed stars. If you look at the diagram, the fixed stars are the outermost sphere between the divine and the cosmic world. And of course, traditional people, the stars appear to be fixed in place as we move on and so forth in the whole geocentric concept of the universe. And to me, this is a poetic way of saying that the triliteral roots are, in fact, themselves sort of direct reflections of archetypes. So that each root, if you can trace each triliteral root back to its original meaning, you will arrive at the name of the archetype, so to speak. So what is the process of tracing back? This is where things get interesting, because here a process, here we come across the idea of a process. This process is called ta'wil. You don't have to know that in Arabic. It's been translated as hermeneutics, again, in Hermes. And the idea is you take a word and begin to trace it back to its source. And this has been done by modern hermeneuticists, mostly in Germany, also in France, but it's also a very traditional way of approaching philosophical questions. Begin with specific words and actually to philologically or pseudo-philologically trace them back to some kind of origin. And a little bit later I'll give you an example of the way a Sufi does this, what we could call Sufi etymology. This idea of ta'wil is very important for an understanding of the Sufi linguistics. Because it's through this process of tracing something back to its origin that we will, in fact, arrive at a triliteral root, and we will, in fact, arrive at a fixed star, which in a sense is a window from the higher world to our world, or the inner world to our outer world. It's probably a good idea to avoid high-low dichotomies here, because they sound so valuable. Of course, from the Islamic point of view, they are valuable. God is higher than us. There's no shame in talking about the high and low, but in my own purpose, it would be practical issues to talk about inside and outside. So you might think that each of these little angels, as they're spiraling down, are also spiraling back in the process of hermeneutics. And we can actually trace the angels' path down and path back through phylology, through the origin of the words themselves. Let me see if I can, let me dig up this, give this quote. This is an analysis of a very important word. I'm going to get to that later. Just take my word for it. It's a Kabbalist, Jewish Kabbalists do the same thing. They're not really interested in what we think of as scientific philology. When they trace a word, when the Sufis or the Kabbalists trace a word, puns come into it, numbers, each letter is assigned a number, and then you can rearrange the numbers and come up with new words, which are then thought to be embedded within the original word in some mystical sense. The words beneath the words, as Saussure called it in another context. So that to trace the meaning of a word is not a scientific endeavor of going through dictionaries and comparative etymology. It is, in fact, an exercise in the imagination with a capital I rather than a small I. It is an exercise in delving to the root and at the same time rising to the fixed thought from the outside to the inside and from the lower to the higher. So what we have here, and this is an image which I'll come back to again. I couldn't find actually a picture of it, but you can imagine it. It's called the tree with its roots in heaven. It's the upside down tree of a good deal of shamanic mythology and also of the major world traditions that also start with this. Usually the axis mundi, the center of the world, the tree of the world is thought of as a tree, like a tree with its roots in the earth and its leaves in the heavens, so to speak. But this is the other way around. This is an upside down tree with its roots in heaven. Because the leaves, the individual words, are what we experience on our level. We don't experience these roots. These roots are, in a sense, hidden. These roots have to be traced with hermeneutics back to their source. And this is such an overpoweringly convincing image of language that we're going to come across it again. One of the most modern and up-to-date schools of linguistics, Chomsky and linguistics. That we won't get to today. So that the leaves are the individual words, the root, the trunk in a sense is the Jacob's ladder, but it's also a bundle of roots in a sense. As you can see, if you cut open the tree, it's a bundle of tubes going to the roots. And so the analogy is a very precise one. And then the roots themselves, which are not only the roots of the word, but also the hidden structure of the tree, are in heaven, are in the sky, but beyond our conscious knowledge. And it's the, I want to bring in now the Latin word vates, V-A-T-E-S, who is a seer, a shaman, and a poet, all in one. Orpheus is your archetypal vates. And it's a concept that we don't quite have a word for in our language, so a seer, a shaman, a poet. As you know, the shaman climbs the world tree usually to search for medicines in primitive societies. The vates, in a sense, could be said to climb the tree in search of words. Search of the roots and meanings of words. So here we have, from the traditional point of view, the task of the poet is this ha'awil, this hermeneutics, is to use words in their archetypal sense, to use words in their original meaning as God understands the word. And only secondarily is there leaves, the blessing of leaves, the language itself, the different languages, the world of the Tower of Babel. Um, So now I want to read into the record some super material. First of all, to give some recapitulation and background, I would read this little script from a book called The Concise Encyclopedia of Islam. This came out as very useful. It's somewhat tendentious and opinionated book. But the take on language here is interesting. Language itself is sacred because of its miraculous power to communicate and to externalize thought. In this sense, language is essentially the same as the divine power of creation. We've already seen that, the words that create. In order to create, God speaks a word in the spirit. Similarly, man externalizes what is within his mind by formulating words with breath, the spiritus, breath, by giving breath form and sound. The power of words to transmit to another consciousness the knowledge of the speaker lies in the fact that true words are themselves what they mean. Words do have substance, according to traditional thought. They are. The sign is not arbitrary. The sign is absolute. It's not sign. Especially in a sacred language like Arabic or Hebrew, which traditions believe with God's language. As I say, the Judeo-Christian tradition used to believe that Hebrew was God's language. I guess there's still fundamentalists who believe that. And in the Islamic world, Arabic is God's language. The Quran is actually God's actual words, crystallized from the roots into the leaves, directly. Or rather, not directly, but through the ancient Gabriel. Always there's an angel in every process of the revelation of words. There is always an angel, sometimes not spoken of, but always present. In the Annunciation to the Virgin, for example, another archetype of this situation. True words are themselves what they mean, or at least they were at their origin. They're the object itself in sound. This is what Adam did. Adam spoke the magical names, the names which are, in fact, the things themselves in their sonic body, so to speak, which is a term from Hindu Buddhist tradition referring to the mantras. And we have the same concept, just quickly passing the Bija mantra, the seed mantra, which is the revealed syllable, the arrangements of the Bija mantras, which are associated with litanies of Hinduism and Buddhism, and then finally ordinary language that still relates to those syllables, but is not in fact directly related. So this same idea, the same hierarchical idea, comes into every tradition I'm familiar with, in one form or another. Sacred languages preserve this original power of language to an eminent degree. Liturgical languages like Latin and the older forms of Greek, the Church Slavonic, have also preserved this power to a lesser degree. In other words, God didn't speak Latin, but because the Church spoke Latin for so many centuries in its rituals, it in a sense acquires a quasi-sacred nature. Letters or phonemes of the language of Arabic in this case correspond to the immutable archetypes. Indeed. Tradition says the letters were taught to Adam by the angel Gabriel. Gabriel, by the way, is not much below this. It's always shown. But the act of which the verbal root is a mysterious incarnation, the sound, the act takes place in consciousness. Thus, the tree of meaning branches from the verbal act root, the sounds being derived from verbal forms. And the images that the language brings forth are ultimately to be traced back to awareness itself. The words are understood as concepts, but they can also shatter concepts or submerge them and return to a threshold between the world and the field mind, the world of imagination. Where the vibration of sound faces creation on the side of perception and the uncreated on the side of cognition. While a given word has a specific meaning determined by convention, it also has a universal sense, which is evoked by its root. Language merges with reality by its root. Thanks to the relationship of words to their roots, as if to a supra-formal archetype, a deeper and more universal sense often superimposes itself upon a particular meaning of the phrase of classical Arabic. Simple statements, which are the rule in the Quran, open stretching vast horizons, the world is reduced to ripples in consciousness. So here we have this two-way motion going through. They both, as you put it, words are understood as concepts, but they also shatter concepts. And this is extremely important. This is the way out of the prison of language. Now, getting down to a more specifically Sufiistic exposition of this idea, this is, I'm going to read a rather long poetic selection here, in a translation that I don't really approve of. It's too wordy. In this book of mine, I translated a short section from this, but it's worth reading the whole thing here since we have the time. What is the term? It's from a poem called The Secret Rose Garden by Shabbos Dayu. You need to know his name, but if you want to make a note, it's S-H-A-B-E-S-T-A-R-I, Shabbos Dayu. He only wrote this one poem of 4,007 lines of his entire life's work, but it contains all the Sufism within it. If you did a complete study of this text, you wouldn't need to let him know what he said. 12th century, rather late, therefore rather synthetic, just a written in Persia. Written in the form of a series of answers to questions that were put to Shabbos Dayu by one of his disciples. And I should point out, by the way, that there is not a literature of traditional linguistics. All of this, what I'm giving now, mostly has to be derived from a very wide acquaintance with traditional theories, because there are no separate works precisely on this subject. You'll find works on etymology, you'll find traditional works on ethnology, you'll find traditional history of words, you'll find traditional works on rhetoric, on various poetic forms, for example. All of which could have bearing on an investigation, but I don't know of any separate work in Islamic literature on what we would call linguistics. This little section of the Secret Rose Garden is almost as close as we can get. And the discussion here is of specific, highly charged metaphorical terms in Sufi poetry, technical terms, if you like, which is that the way the word is often called. So these are some terribly important words that appear over and over again in Sufi poetry. And in fact, the question specifically deals with erotic nature. Because the questioner says, I'm going to have to, as I read this translation, which is really dull, by a good friend of mine, but I may sort of pause and reconnect and say something. The question is, what does the man of spiritual sense signify by poetical tropes and epithets, such as lips and eyes, with down or marks of beauty, tresses, tips? What use is there with these words for one who fares within inner states? For one who is engaged on the stations of the way. Now, the reason for this question is because so much of the culture is using love symbolism. It's almost universal. That the love is God, so to speak, or the link to God. And therefore, all the erotic signs of the beloved become a language. So what he's asking asking you, what is this semiotic system and why should it be of any use to a serious mystic? Isn't this just, in fact, some frippery of the poets? Chokhsari says, no, this is actually serious business, and the reason is, whatever is plain to see, whatever is visible in this world, is all facsimile, a reflection cast by that world's sun, that world, the overworld, yonder and invisible. This is pure Platonism, of course. This is the cage. This is the cage that's coming to the world. The real things are outside the cage. We're just seeing the reflections. The same goes for words here in the beginning of the book. The world is like, this world is like a line of down, or like an eyebrow, a beauty mark, or a curl. Everything is perfect, beautiful in its own proper place. The Sufis, like the Platonists, were not against the material world. Many of them looked on it as a means to a higher world, but in itself that made it good. This is not Gnostic dualism, you didn't have to escape from the world of matter. The world of matter itself is going to lift you up, it's going to help you transcend. Because all of this is perfect and beautiful in its proper place. Just as we learned from the Federal and the Symposium of Plato, where you might be most familiar with the subject. Because the theophanic light shines, this is God's light, association with it. The theophanic face of God, the manifestation of God, not just the divine light, but the light of God manifestation in the world. Because this light shines, sometimes through wrath and sometimes through beauty, sometimes irradiated through beauty, the face and the tress convey such sense with all their sheen is arrayed. Are but symbols that do set it forth, says the old translator, Johnson Pasha. A late 19th century translator, also completely inadequate in English. Anyway, what is he really saying? Because there are irradiations of the divine qualities of wrath and beauty, and these very terms, the face and the tress, when you understand them, convey the sense of both wrath and beauty. Such sublime qualities that reality possesses, aspects of benign beauty and violent majesty, the female faces, the curls of beloved idols, express all that. Letters and words are sensible when heard at first, that is to say, they seem to be things. To purely sensible things, their primal assignation of the best. At first, it seems as if words were created. The word desk must have been created to refer to a desk. That seems logical. You believe in created a revealed language. The mundus archetypus, the world of the archetype, the world of the imagination. The endless, the infinite. Words are quite unfit to interpret it. No exegesis can express its ultimate extent. The mystical significance unveiled. No philological interpretation reveals the mystical significance which is unveiled and experienced by the heart taste, the intuitive spirit of intuition, the eye of the heart. So he's saying now that there is a beyond one. But, here comes the catch, the archetypal meaning, the esoteric sense or sins in the way that the trivial poets use that word, analogies and correspondences, the heart's initiates, the best next to the heart's, it turns everything around, it's all the dramatic way. The heart's, the people of the heart, the Zui, can explain these archetypes, the esoteric sense of words, via analogies and correspondences, correspondence, again, Rimbaud is dealing with that. Corresponds between the bowel of the color, corresponds between the archetype and the realization of the archetype. These objects, the real sense, are tenuous shadows, shades that
But to me, says Chodosari, these words instate or convey a more primordial sense. Those archetypal meanings, although at first their designation related to sensible things, yet the vulgar, the people with no understanding, they only see them as sensible things. What hope is there that the common man could comprehend this intention or sense of archetypal meaning? The sensible mean was all the world of vision. Well, I believe these words were first assigned to their celestial meanings, but the proud know all things but by sensual images. So what do they know means mystical? In other words, the shocking thing that Chodosari is saying here is that these words weren't coined to refer to this eyebrow or that eyebrow, but to the eyebrow, the archetype. The original use of words was to reveal the archetype. This is clear from the story of Adam. The names that Adam reveals are the real names. The names that the magician knows, for example, are the real names by which a thing can actually be controlled, the things respond. And not that theory of correspondence is to their real names. They're all the secret names, words, and the real. So the remarkable turnaround here is that these words weren't revealed to tell us about our material world. They were revealed to us in the material world to tell us about that world, the spiritual world. And that later on, those who don't understand, the vulgar, the uninitiated, reassign these words to this idea, to that idea. Cast her glance upon the world, she changed those words and made them bear the sense that's now assigned to them. Reason has a very low reputation in Suleiman and works on his own. Also, he means worldly reason, again, the god of grammar, so to speak. And when wise men turn their thoughts to mystic words, they pay regard to due proportion and resemblance. So, whenever a wise man comes, all these original meanings of the word are rediscovered. Though perfect analogy be unattainable, yet be thou ever constant in its search. In other words, a truly perfect magical language is not impossible, but the whole point of poetry is to strive toward it. Thou canst not meet reproach from anyone, for neither there is none save God himself. Truth itself is the only priest and conqueror. However, beware, because any ego, of any I-ness, you are aware, you are still prepossessed with self. The outer world in the sense of the, the outer world in the sense of the divine law, which is almost limited to the divine law of Sharia, the law of code. Indulgence in speech is granted only to initiates. And then only in a free spiritual state, intoxication, love-worn infatuation, or else annihilation. In other words, only in very high spiritual states can the word emerge with the archetype. Otherwise, if you can't do that, you better just shut up. Only those mystics who are intimate with these three states can realize the correct application of these words and know their ultimate significance. And since to you, you vulgar, that ecstasy is alien and rapture is foreign, beware lest you, by dumb mimicry of the Gnostics, become an infidel in the ignorant of the chance. Reality spiritual states aren't fanciful figures of speech. The arcana of the path can never be understood by the common man. On my time, inflated lies, hyperbole, Gnostics never did preach inflated lies and hyperbole. Only this truth can teach you the heart condition, the heart's vision. Only the heart vision can teach you both the vocal letter and the archetypal sense. I'm going to retranslate this to these skipping a couple of lines here. Plumb the spirit's depth and conceive the ultimate within your intention. Within each simile, within each analogy, perceive the divine unique anagogy. Let the metaphors you strike be types precise types. The analogy you make approach, let that be concise, and dismiss all other forms of analogy. So, I think this is clear. There's some excellent commentary from another sermon book, Brian P. I just want to keep in mind the reaction to this. I think what we have here is in brief theory of traditional linguistics, if we can transpose from poetic metaphor to the whole idea of language itself. And I think the Chavasari would have made that transposition if he'd been asked specifically about language rather than about poetic metaphors. Because he seems to be making this whole this whole arrangement very clear. Unfortunately, my friend Leonard has not made it all that clear. It's a very difficult word to translate, very difficult. It's so concise and comes so late in the tradition. So much background to understand a little bit every bit of juice out of every line. But basically, this is what he's describing. And he's talking about the poet's task, that Jacob's ladder journey to the Vate side, through